get my shoes and out the door. 5, I'm alive. 6, 7, 8, feeling great. Hello, BYWG Podcast Tribe. This is Dr. Noah. For the month of March 2019, the book of the month is none other than Vani Hari's new release, Feeding You Lies. And a product of the month is the entire line of superfoods from Four Sigmatic. As a reminder, all the links for the product in the book of the month will be listed in the show notes in iTunes, in our weekly newsletter, and on our website at www.beyondyourwildestgenes.com at the Listen Now tab. Our book of the month is Feeding You Lies by Vani Hari, How to Unravel the Food Industry's Playbook and Reclaim Your Health. Dr. Mike interviewed Vani on the Beyond Your Wildest Genes podcast, and it was released on February 18th. You can listen to this release on our website, on your smartphone, YouTube, or Spotify. The product of the month is one of our favorite superfood companies, Four Sigmatic. They carry an incredible line of mushroom coffees, functional mushroom elixirs, and a brand new beauty line, and a few new products that I personally really enjoy, like Golden Latte Mushroom Mix, Mushroom Matcha Latte Mix, and Lion's Mane Focus Shots. A quick tip from us to staying healthy through the winter months is to try out their Shaga Mushroom-containing products. You can also listen to me interview the founder of Four Sigmatic, Taro, twice on the BYWG podcast in the archives and our website as well. Enjoy the upcoming podcast. Hello and welcome back to Beyond Your Wildest Genes podcast. My name is Dr. Noah DeCoyer and I am your co-host. A good friend of mine and multiple-time BYWG podcast guest, Dr. Guillermo Ruiz, sent me an advanced copy of our guest book several weeks ago, The Metabolism Reset Diet. And today is my pleasure to introduce to you the author, Dr. Alan Christensen. So excited to have you on today. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Dr. Noah. How you doing?
Oh my, I'm doing excellent, excellent today. I just had a great cup of coffee at a new local coffee shop that opened up, and it was absolutely incredible. But let me do your modest bio, and then we'll get started. Sound good?
Sure.
All right. So Dr. Alan Christensen is a naturopathic endocrinologist who focuses on thyroid function, adrenal health, and metabolism. He has been actively practicing in the Scottsdale area since 1996 and is the founding physician behind Integrative Health. He is a New York Times bestselling author whose books include The Metabolism Reset Diet, The Adrenal Reset Diet, The Complete Idiot's Guide to Thyroid Disease. Dr. Christensen regularly appears on national media like Dr. Oz, The Doctors, and The Today's Show. Dr. Christensen, since this is your first time on the podcast, do you mind giving a little bit of the backstory, your bio, flesh out your story a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, the short of it was that I came into this because I had a lot of my own health struggles and, you know, really got to understand what a big deal it was to have your body not work in the ways you wanted and have to work hard to maintain that. So I had seizures as an extension from cerebral palsy as a kid. And, you know, a lot of ways I couldn't move well and couldn't really be active or do sports. And I went to a pretty dark place by about adolescence because, yeah, I just felt the sting of social rejection and nerds were far from cool then. And, you know, I was much rounder than anyone else who was in my peer groups. And yeah, and I worked hard to figure out some ways to change that. A lot of things I tried didn't work, but with some persistence and with the help of some great authors, it changed my life. And I realized, you know, that if your health is not where you want it, nothing else really matters. Information can change that, and it may not come from the sources you would expect. So yeah, powerful experience for me.
Did you say you were diagnosed with cerebral palsy as a child? That I did not know.
Yeah, I had seizures and I had a lot of movement defects. See, my legs, when I would try to run, rather than going front to back, my lower legs, they would go laterally, it would go more sideways. And so I was just, you know, clumsy and I was twisting my ankles and doing things like that and just couldn't do physical activities. And yeah.
Wow. Wow. So you had just written a great new book, and I want to start here. Dr. Christensen, what would you consider a healthy metabolism?
You know, yeah, great question. We've been led to think that it's just normal to have to fight to be at a good body weight. And most folks think that's just like the normal lot in life. And I argue that if you've got a normal, healthy metabolism, it should sort itself out, you know, that you should have a appropriate, healthy appetite, and that if you follow it, you'll be at a good weight, a size that you feel good about, and energy levels will be pretty stable. So that's what should happen from a good metabolism. And if those things aren't true, it isn't that you've not tried hard enough. It means that there's something off with how your metabolism is working.
And is this what inspired you to write this new book? Because I mean, I know you're a thyroid expert. I know your last book was focused on the adrenals, but where did the desire to write this particular book come from?
Yeah, you know, it was really meeting the need of those who had already done a lot. Maybe they squared away their thyroid function, or maybe they've got their cortisol rhythms back again, but they're still not where they felt they could be, especially with their waist. You know, we had a protocol that we evolved for treating diabetes type 2, and saw it work really well. We've done it for probably coming up on a decade now and thousands of people. And something we saw was that, yes, it would often cause weight loss, but we realized that the waist loss, that the inches reduction, was very dramatic and unexpected. You know, most data suggests that for a woman to lose an inch around her waist, she probably has to lose, you know, 6 to 10 pounds or so. And we were commonly seeing 1 to 2, 3 pounds for every inch lost, and lots of inches coming down. And then I started learning more about fatty liver and the overlap between that and diabetes. And it came to connect some facts that the liver was a big part of managing our metabolism. And like a lot of things, you know, diabetes or thyroid disease, there's a continuum. And it's not so much that you're perfect until there's a problem. It's that, you know, there's a range between things working worse and worse and worse. And then you pass some line in the sand, and now we say there's a disease. And many people that don't have obvious fatty liver disease probably still have it, but it's not been diagnosed. And even those that wouldn't have it to that level, you know, if you've got more than 5% of your liver made up by triglycerides, we call that fatty liver. Healthy liver is probably about 0.5%, but 4.9 is still a problem. And so the argument is that a lot of people, to where their waist size and their energy don't just sync up automatically, there's probably some issues taking place with the liver function.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. You know, I got the book from Dr. Ruiz, and I started diving into it, and I'm looking at the title, Repair Your Liver, Stop Storing Fat, and immediately I just wasn't aware enough about what, you know, factors the liver has with metabolism. So can you lay that out for us a little bit more?
You know, for sure. So our bodies are always using energy, you know, fuel from our food. We're also using tons of micronutrients, like in every moment, and hormones, hormone byproducts, amino acids, neurotransmitters. There's all this stuff we're constantly using. And of course, it ultimately all comes from our diet. Some things are just straight shots, like we get B12 and we use B12. But a lot of things are converted, or they're made, or they're activated. And we only take in food, you know, a certain number of times per day. And we don't use all of it we take in instantly. We use a lot of it afterward. And so the liver, it's a lot more than just like a filter or a detox organ. It is, but it's also a storehouse. So all these essential nutrients, these building blocks, and this fuel, our liver's holding on to that and then letting it out when our body needs it. And when it works well, you know, you take on a meal and you don't need all of it in the second you swallow it. So you store it away till later, and your liver's got room for that. And then if there's ever times to where you fall short, a day you have less than you need, your liver makes up for that difference.
Right. And I want to touch upon this later, but the liver also produces ketones, correct? If you totally deplete your triglyceride stores?
Well, so funny thing, not so much if you deplete your triglyceride stores, more so if you deplete your glycogen stores.
That's what I meant, glycogen. So, I apologize.
Yeah. The liver will convert. And that's the funny thing we think about ketones as a byproduct of burning fat. They're really the opposite. They're a product of being unable to burn fat. So when beta oxidation shuts down, the body can't burn fat for fuel anymore, then fat gets converted into ketones. And then that's a different version of fuel, but it's still a type of fuel. And it's the one kind of fuel the liver can't use by itself anymore.
Right. That's true. True. Now, does this reset diet, does this focus on getting the liver more healthy? Is that as simple as it sounds, or is there much more to it?
You know, that really is as simple as it sounds. There's, of course, details and methods, but that's the gist of it. And by healthy, you know, you mentioned the triglycerides and glycogen, so I'll expand on those. I think about the fuel in your liver as being in two forms, and triglycerides are a real powerful fuel. They store a lot of energy. They're pretty compact. They're not binding up with water, which means they take up less room, and you can have a lot of energy in triglycerides. And you can make them out of all kinds of things, you know, carbs, fats, ketones, even alcohol. They can all turn into triglycerides. Now, because they're so energy dense, think about like a big log. You know, you need to ignite that in some way. So you need lighter fluid or kindling or some way that's easier, that doesn't produce as much energy as long, but is easier to ignite. And then you can get the log burning. Well, that kindling is glycogen. So a healthy liver has proportions of each of those fuel types. And if you've got glycogen, you can burn fat effectively. But the pitfall is that when there's too much triglyceride, you know, they've shown pictomicrographs, microscopic scans of liver cells when someone has fatty liver, and you can see just these white, milky globules, these sphericals of fat, of triglycerides, and they're compressing the cell. They're literally squeezing everything in the corner. And the stuff that gets squeezed includes the nucleus of the cell, which has the mitochondria, but also the glycogen vesicles. So there's less room for glycogen. So there's this state in which there's so much triglyceride, your body it doesn't have what it needs to burn triglyceride. And even then, you can still store more triglyceride outside the cell, even if inside the cell is full. So you can reach a state where when you take on a meal, even if that meal is less than you need for fuel for the whole day, you can't burn it all in that instant. So you've got to store some. And if your liver cells are that compressed, that's going to mean triglyceride formation. And however, it's become a one-way street because your body lacks the spark to burn the triglycerides. So even if you're not eating more food than you need, all of what you're consuming gets turned into triglycerides, and too little of that can get brought back out for energy. And that's the whole cycle of fatty liver syndrome.
Yeah, that's a definitive problem. Now, what are some of the other finer details in the book? The whole diet thing, you know, boggles people's minds. You've written a couple diet books already. So, what are some of the finer details here?
You know, it's a good point. And it's a funny thing because I struggled with even calling it a diet, because the idea is to really make it to where people have to think about a diet as something you do forever. And this is really a, you know, get in, make a change and get done and get out, you know. And
right.
My experience is that someone who's going to go out of their way to listen to someone like yourself, they're conscientious of their health, and you've educated them. They're aware of more things than the average person is. But a lot of the things they're doing are not seeming to give them the results they would expect. And so the idea behind this is that you can change your body in a way to where you get better, it's more fair. You get more results from the hard efforts you're putting in and the good things you're already doing. And some of the finer points, I mentioned how the trick is to get glycogen back, but then tap into the triglyceride stores. And that takes a little nuance. You know, it requires having supplies of protein for the liver. It requires a fair amount of micronutrients, but also it needs blood sugar levels to be really stable. And that can be hard to do when there's a drop in total food intake. So I relied heavily on a thing called resistant starch. It's pretty uniquely able to yield about 6 to 9 hours of stable blood sugar with a low food intake. So yeah, the whole combination makes it to where the liver is rejuvenated and it's able to burn its stored fat again effectively.
I'm glad you brought up resistant starch, because again, when I started reading the book and diving into it, I noticed how heavily reliant it was on resistant starch. And resistant starch comes in many different forms: cooked and cooled rice, cooked and cooled potatoes, beans. I've been tinkering around with konjac root or glucomannan, which I don't think is mentioned in your book. But talk a little bit more about resistant starch, because that's something that I don't think a lot of people are still very familiar with.
You know, it's pretty exciting stuff. carbohydrates, a big family with a lot of very different members. Everything from spinach to Coca-Cola could be in the family, so they're not all the same. And then we've got fibers. We always talk about fiber as a thing, but fibers are also a family of food chemicals. And fibers are unique in that they feed the flora, but they're not nutritive for us. We can't use them for fuel. And then carbohydrates, the opposite. You know, they feed us. We often require some management with hormones like insulin or glucagon. Resistant starch straddles the fence. It does the best of both and the worst of neither. You know, it does give us fuel. Go ahead. What's that?
Oh, I didn't say anything. I'm sorry.
My mistake. Yeah, it does give us fuel, but not in the way that carbohydrate does. It doesn't absorb in the small intestine, doesn't require insulin to manage. Rather, it feeds good bacteria first, and they make large amounts of short-chain fats out of that. And we're able to use a fair amount of their metabolites directly as fuel. And because this is happening in the colon, it starts quite a while after you eat it, and it takes a long time to work. And because there's no hormonal control required, your blood sugar is like rock solid for many, many hours. It's unlike any other food. You know, for a while, we used to think that if the goal was to keep blood sugar stable and low, all one had to do was not consume any source of carbohydrate that could turn into sugar. And it seemed intuitive enough, but what happened was that the research technology raised the bar. And now in research studies, not so much like in clinical studies, but in research studies, they can measure someone's blood sugar and they can tell how much blood sugar came from a meal and how much came from the body releasing it from storage, from the liver especially. And it turns out those who have weight struggles or prediabetes or diabetes, that the old idea of, you know, eating carbohydrates, spiking your blood sugar, making insulin, going to storage, that just doesn't pan out that way. What happens is that 85% or more of their postprandial hyperglycemia, their high blood sugar after a meal, 85% or more of that has nothing to do with the meal. It doesn't come from the food at all. It's what the body is releasing out.
So how do people, if they decide to embark on this plan, how does resistant starch, how does it fit in? Is it in a powder? Is it in consuming, you know, like cooked, like I said, cooked and cooled rice? Is it in smoothies? Like, how does that whole thing work?
You gave several good food, great food sources of that. And I did make a custom powder called RS Complete. The tricky part about making it is that there's a lot of things out there that people ask about, like green banana flour, potato flour, whatnot, that should have it. And probably 3 years ago when I first set out to make this product, I thought it would just be the easiest thing in the world because those were readily available and not expensive. I thought we could just blend those up and make it taste nice and put a label on it and call it good. And boy, that was not how it panned out. So there really wasn't any commonly available methodology for standardizing resistant starch, for saying how much was in a product. So we had to develop that. Once we developed that, what we found was that these types of powders might have, you know, a potato, unmodified potato starch you could buy on Amazon, it might be 2% RS or it might be 60% RS. And from the same manufacturer, from batch to batch, it's completely different. So that's one pitfall about the powders. You know, we made one that's standardized, but otherwise I wouldn't advise those. In the book, I talk a lot about some great food options. One thing I used was aquafaba, the liquid from cooking beans. You know, you talked about potatoes is a great one. Bananas and plantains used in the right ways, they're good options too. But yeah, I did add those a lot to shakes, and then also talked about just routine food sources of those to add with the evening meals.
I guess I want to take this from a personal perspective. I've been, like I said, tinkering around with the resistant starches for a while now. Some I find, to be quite honest, give me a lot of a gas. I don't know how else to say it. What's happening there? Like, and primarily from beans. And I come in and out of ketosis at times. I basically structure my diet in a paleo primal type way. But I do enjoy rice. I do enjoy potatoes, and I do like beans. But I there's many times I just. The gas is just a significant issue. So what's going on there with me?
For sure. So whenever we hear that, it's really common that someone whose diet has been restrictive of a lot of food categories, their flora starts to lack diversity and resilience. And we never lose all types of our flora, but the proportions change radically. And it's if your diet is too low in, so I talk about fibers. There's about 17 categories of fibers in a varied diet. And once someone cuts out a lot of food categories like whole grains or beans or nuts or seeds or certain categories, then there's just no other sources for many of the fibers. You know, if you're off of legumes and whole grains, for example, of those 17 possible types of fibers, you're down to about like 8. So the flora becomes weakened. It's kind of like an antibiotic almost. And the solution is really just to, you know, two ways to go about it. I tell people, it's like, how do you like to take off a Band-Aid? Do you want to just like rip it off and be done? Or do you want to do it slow and gentle? So the first one is just keep doing it. And the gas does pass, no pun intended. The other one is just take baby steps. They've done studies on this exact process. So when beans are a problem, they are the only source of a trisaccharide called raffinose. And that's just like the ultimate food for bifidobacter. So a lot of folks that are intolerant of beans and legumes, they've had a compromise to their bifidobacter species. And the trick there is, if you do about a tablespoon serving daily for 2 weeks, most people can tolerate normal servings afterwards and do totally fine with them. And for whatever reason, pintos and lentils seem to be the easiest gateway drugs as far as beans go. So yeah, shoot for a tablespoon of lentils every day for 2 weeks. And then afterwards, you can often test larger amounts and do fine with them.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I've tried a lot of different things. I've cooked the heck out of them. I've Instapotted them. I've tried to eliminate the lectin content. You know, like I'm trying all these different things. And maybe it's just as simple as starting out with, like you said, just smaller amounts and working my way through and becoming more tolerant to them.
Here's a surprising thing you might appreciate. There was a study done on how those who were having a hard time digesting beans at first, how it was affected by different cooking methods. And you talked about, high pressure cooking, durations of soaking or whatnot. None had any differences, you know, whether they were soaked or not, whether they were high pressure cooked. Now, you don't want them raw. You need them cooked. That's just for safety purposes. But past that point, you could take dry ones. Lentils are often really easy in that regard also for cooking. You can just take plain old dry ones and add them to about 3 parts of liquid and give them an hour simmer. And yeah, just try a tablespoon a day for a couple of weeks and see where you can go from there.
That's cool. And now, so that fiber is fostering the growth of the bacteria that will eat that fiber. It's kind of like a two-way cycle, right? Is that what's happening?
Spot on, exactly. And we never have none of them, but we can just have a lot less so they can come back with exposure.
Right. And would supplementation with specific probiotics help too, or is it really the starch that we really need? Like that prebiotic is far more effective and better long-term strategy.
You know, it's a good distinction you drew out there between probiotics and prebiotics. And the pitfall is that the organisms that we think are most relevant are ones that are anaerobic. They live outside of oxygen. And probiotics, they're always aerobic organisms, and they probably make up 0.5% or maybe 1% of our flora. So they're really like just the tail wagging the dog. So prebiotics and food sources are just much, much more powerful for this purpose.
So this is a commercial for having a very high variety, high starch, high vegetable, high non-starchy vegetable diet. Is that fair to say?
You know, all the food categories, for sure. There's been many situations in which people have celiac they weren't aware of, or they got some food intolerances. But I honestly think we've gone too far in terms of making food be the villain. For sure, there's really not a place in a healthy person's life to have a whole lot of Twinkies or Big Macs. So not non-food stuff. That doesn't come into this discussion. But categories of food that our grandparents could have eaten, you know, we're better off to have more categories rather than fewer in terms of our variety and nutritional diversity in our gut flora.
Maybe I'm wrong, but did I not notice eggs in this program, this short-term program? Am I mistaken on that or no?
I did include eggs. I did mention that there certainly are those who have issues to them, but I included those as one of the protein options.
Okay, it is one of the protein options. Okay, all right. Talk to me a little bit about, just switching gears a little bit, metabolic flexibility.
Yeah, so I think a lot of listeners could think of someone, maybe a friend that they kind of love to hate, that seems to do everything wrong with their health and yet still has no apparent health issues. I think those people are getting rarer and rarer, but they seem to be around still. And then there's other people that the listeners, this might be themselves, to where it seems they've got to just like be on a tightrope to get things right, to make it kind of work. And that's the metabolic flexibility. You know, when it's good, your body has leeway. Giraffes don't wear fit trackers and count their leaves as they're chewing them. You know, it all sorts itself out. And that's what our bodies should be able to do. And when the liver has adequate space for triglycerides and it's got some glycogen but room to take on more, that's when that works well. And it's almost like your body has this series of bowls, and you fill one, and when that fills up, it fills up the next. And that's where your food goes, the fuel from your food goes. So the fats, the carbs, even like ketones, they go in these consecutive bowls. And the first one's going to be really muscle tissue. So when your muscles have space, when they're hungry, when they're active, they will take on both fat and sugar. You know, fats and starches, they can take that up and store that. When they start to get overburdened, or they're just not very hungry because they're not very activated, then the subcutaneous, the fat under the skin, becomes the next bowl. And then past that one, we think about the visceral fat. And then past that bowl, we think about the liver and the pancreas. And then when they can't take on anymore, we're getting fat that builds up between the cells of those organs. And that's really where disease comes in. That's when we get all the health complications. And that's why there are some people who are heavy but still healthy, because whatever reason, they're more able to make fat cells, and they can keep more of this toxic fuel overload away from the organ tissue. And that's also why other people who may not be heavy still can have diabetes and other complications, because they it's an ironic thing, but they can't get fat as well. And if they could get fatter, they wouldn't get sick. You know, if they could make larger fat cells and more of them, they would have safer places just to dump that extra fuel. But some can't do that as well. And with less, they've got a different fuel set point, and it more quickly builds up inside the organs for them.
That answers a lot of questions for a lot of people. I'm glad you brought that up. What else? Did I miss anything? What else can our audience expect from this new book?
You know, I guess the thing that excites me the most is that your body can change in a way that lasts, and it doesn't take forever, you know. And then another thing that's really, really lit us up to see is that because we first did this for diabetes, we love to see that reverse. We love to see blood sugar get better, but it's not a surprise anymore. Same thing about blood triglycerides or blood cholesterol. We expect that. But now that we've had so many people joining an online program and participating in that, I've come to realize that this fuel excess is probably the most core cause of a lot of chronic inflammation. You know, many who thought that their big problem was a chronic infection, that went away once their organ fat cleared out and their immune system got healthier, or a lot of folks would have their rheumatoid arthritis do much better, or their thyroid antibodies plummet. So I think there's a lot of different common issues to where inflammation is the cause, and these adipokines, these toxic cytokines that come from organ fat, that's like the prime source of that. So your body can get healthy in a lot of ways. It doesn't take forever, and it can become more of a lasting state for you.
You briefly touched upon something there. Are you talking about like overfed? Are we just simply one of the things we do as societies in general is just eat too much?
Well, there's a couple of facets to this, and somehow or other, there's more fuel than we can utilize, and for sure that can be one part of the equation. The other part is that we don't use fuel as effectively.
Okay.
And this is kind of bizarre, but the data that I've seen does not suggest that our activity levels are different than they have been in the past, even compared to some early societies. You know, for sure, a lot of people have sedentary lives, but if we look back at the 50s, we're probably more active in terms of how many people go to gyms and go out of their way to exercise than we were back then. And we had much less of the same health problems then. I've even seen some studies about some of the existing hunter-gatherer societies, and their activity is not that radically different from what it is from many. So there certainly is the concern about just movement and muscle activation. And there's debates about how much of it is structured movement versus how much of it is long blocks of being sedentary that's the culprit. So there's how well we burn fuel and how much fuel we burn, as well as how much fuel that comes in. And then there's whether the pilot light is on or not, you know, whether or not we can ignite the fuel that we have. And that comes down to micronutrient status. That comes down to things like our body's level of regulating hormone balance, especially thyroid and adrenal function. And then also we can see things like toxicants that can impair that part of the whole equation. So yeah, so those three things, you know, how much fuel do we have to work with? How much fuel are we going to burn? And then how well can we ignite the fuel?
That's a great answer. I'd like to ask your thoughts on two very hot topics today, just because I know you're going to have a great answer. What are some of your thoughts about intermittent fasting and then the ketogenic diet?
For sure. So, you know, one blanket statement I love to make is that there's a lot of people that have done things that are very different from one to another and had very positive outcomes from that. And I completely honor that, and I'm glad they did. And, you know, that's all cool. So if you did one of those things and it worked well for you, that's awesome. My thought is that I'm trying to figure out what's most likely to work for the largest number of people who have problems with their liver function. And so that's the lens that I'm looking through. So I never want to really come between someone and what's been effective for them. The thought about the ketogenic diet, and we inadvertently came on some of these points, right. A pitfall in the context of liver function is that the liver can't use ketones for fuel. And towards the goal of replenishing glycogen, that's pretty much the exact opposite goal of ketogenesis. You're trying to deplete glycogen. And so if there is a lot of breakdown of stored fat, that's actually more work for your liver and not less work for your liver. And if your liver has no fuel to function itself, then that's a more difficult time for it. That impairs its ability to detoxify effectively. So yeah. And then intermittent fasting. For some people, it seems that that's a handy way they end up consuming less food. Like if they have a window of time that they consume less in, like the time-restricted feeding, or if they choose days to eat less than others. For some, it seems to work well that way. So far, all the large group studies have shown that the extent to which there are health improvements, they correlate with the degree of how much less food the person ate. So it seems that it's more of a way of eating less food than it is a matter of changing the body's response to food. So it's not so much that the timing makes you, you know, that if you had eaten the same amount of food in a different time window, it would have worked the same way. But for some people, that's a handy way. But group effects have not yet shown that for overall groups, that it's more effective for groups. So yeah, if an individual says it's worked well, that's great. But so far, it seems that there's no metabolic advantage to the timing of the food in that context.
What I really appreciate about your answers are you're citing like research studies and large group studies, which is the best way to do it. No speculation there.
You know, and that's the thing is that there's two ways to go about gathering health data. One way, like you said, is speculate. You can think of a lot of ideas that might really make sense, and some of those could pan out over time, but a lot of them don't. You know, a lot of good ideas. The body is often very counterintuitive. It regulates so much that things don't always work out the way it would seem at first pass. So yeah, I'd love to put more weight on data we see from actual outcome studies of people.
Yeah, that's much much better way to go about things. Okay, two final questions. One, I have asked all my guests for much longer than a year. From waking to sleeping, Doc, what is like your daily routine?
Well, you know, I typically have serial obsessions in terms of recreational activities, and that is a big part of the answer. My biggest love and my biggest struggle early in life was running, and a lot of the complications of cerebral palsy are still with me. And in 2014 to 2015, I had about 5 major surgeries, and in the last 6 months, I say that I'm about 95% recovered from those, and I'm in a better place structurally than I've been my whole life. So I'm obsessed with my running in a big way, and that's a lot of my routines revolve around that. You know, I get up at about 4, and this morning I have a coach that I get workouts from, and so I follow her plans and, you know, upload the workouts, and she analyzes that. So I was up early and did a run and did some rehab stuff, and after that, I like to have time to finish that up so I can still make my son breakfast and prep my food for the day and see him off to school. And then most days I'm researching and writing, or, you know, like now doing a lot of interviews with the book, things along these lines. You know, I prep most of my food in the morning, and I'll just work on that throughout the day, often leftovers from the day before. Afternoon, I'll pick my son up from school. My wife takes him in the morning. We take turns that way. And evenings, you know, hang out, dinner as a family. Usually to bed by about 8. I'm pretty boring that way. And, you know, read a little bit in the evening. And that's a typical day.
That's great. Now, people love to hear what other people's routines are. I know I learn a lot about people and what I can implement into my life by listening to people's routines. So thank you for answering that. particularly when it deals with family. And I have two boys too, and a lot of it, as busy as I am, a lot of it revolves around what they're doing and getting them out of the house and going to see their sporting events and things of that nature.
Yeah, that's the stuff that matters the most.
Yes, sir. And what's the best way for our audience to reach you?
Easy thing, the new book, any place you can pick up books at. If you're lucky to have a local independent bookstore, please give them some love and see if they don't have a copy of it. But anywhere you buy books, you can find it. And me, drchristensen.com, drchristensen. I show up pretty readily on Google searches. So yeah, just Dr. Christensen, I'll be there. That's my main hub, is that website.
Great. And your facility is in Arizona, right? If anybody's listening that lives in the Scottsdale area, correct?
Exactly. We're Scottsdale, Arizona, and probably about 30-40% of our patients do travel from out of state or to come see us, and we work with folks over the distance afterward, and it's a great thing. You mentioned Dr. Ruiz and Dr. Turner, and I'm just super thankful to get to hang out with these brilliant people that I learn from as well, and we can challenge each other and grow and share in the joys of helping people get their health back again.
Yeah, I totally agree. Thank you, Doc. Any last words?
You know, just the idea of having everyone know that your health matters immensely, and that if it's not where you think it should be, it can be. Just don't give up and keep listening to good resources like Dr. Noah, and keep on trying things and being persistent, and know that good change is possible.
My name is Dr. Noah DeCoyer, your co-host, and you're listening to the Beyond Your Wildest Genes podcast. If you like what you've heard today, please share this with your friends and encourage them to subscribe on iTunes. Leaving a review helps very much. You can subscribe to our weekly email at www.beyondyourwildestgenes.com. And as my oldest son Hayden says, thank you, and be awesome and never unawesome.